Well, good evening. Welcome to this live stream event on the 2nd of August 2021. Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics here. Great to have you on this evening. Very important conversation, this, about energy and specifically gas. It amazes me just how complex the issue is, how important the issue is, and yet how underreported it is. So that's why this is a really important conversation. Just before I bring David in, we'll remind you, as normal, we don't provide specific financial legal advice on the channel, just a general conversation. The chat is moderated, but feel free to ask questions and indulge in all sorts of chat as you like. It's all part of the community, of course, as at the 2nd of August, if you're watching in replay. If you want to ask a question, use that What the World to get my attention. I've also enabled Super Chat, which means that you can get your question top of the list or indeed make a contribution to what we do here. Right, well, with that, let me bring David in. David, hello.
G'day, Martin. Thanks for having me.
Well, I really appreciate your coming on. And I think this is one of the most important conversations I've ever had because we are at a critical inflection point with regard to the whole energy question, aren't we? And there's some big, big issues there. And unfortunately, some of our political leaders don't want to go there. But before we get into the detail, would you like just to give a little bit of an overview of yourself and your background? Because I think people need to understand that, you know, you're talking not just theoretically, but actually you've been involved in a number of different ways through your career. So this is a very powerful conversation.
Sure. So my name's David Llewellyn Smith. I guess my first dalliance with energy was through the Diplomat magazine, where I was global economy editor. And we worked a lot on LNG and the development of Australia as an LNG superpower. Between, you know, kind of after the millennium, I guess. Then I was involved with Ross Garnaut writing a couple of books. First one was about the GFC, and then I edited the second Garnaut Climate Change Review, which gave me a lot more exposure to energy. And around that time, founded Macro Business as well with LVO, Leif Van Onselen. Basically became the energy analyst at MB straight away, because even then there were, that was actually the crucible for the problems that we have today, in fact. I've been in and around energy for 20 years and writing about it. And now, of course, I'm with Nucleus Wealth as well, which your viewers will be familiar with as the chief strategist. So, Coming from all angles.
And just to be clear, a chief strategist means what?
Oh, it's a grandiose title for drinking lots of coffee. I'm sort of the guy that tackles the big top-down questions. So Damien is the chief investment officer and looks at markets from the bottom up. So that's earnings and business cases and business plans and, you know, all the detail that goes into stocks and stock markets from the bottom up. I'm the top-down guy who looks at the macro, you know, the super trends, the political economy, and the, you know, the big historical stuff. The theory is that those two things meet bottom up and top down for good returns.
Yeah, somewhere in the middle, hopefully.
That's right.
Now, this is a conversation about energy. I think it's very important to sort of define the playing field, right? Because I guess the first observation is energy is a global market, isn't it? So anything that we think about and how energy works has to be in the context of what's happening, you know, internationally, the big picture stuff, as well as the micro stuff here.
Well, I mean, that's a really interesting question. Energy is a global market for Australia now, and has been for many years on some fuels. excuse me. So coal, for instance, various forms of coal and oil at other times. But until 2014, gas was terrestrial. It was landlocked in Australia, and it wasn't part of the global market. And that's very central to tonight's conversation, is how we connected our gas to the global market, and how that has created an absolute debacle for us.
Yeah, okay. Well, maybe we should unpack that a little bit more and talk a little bit about the history. I mean, we did a show about a month, 6 weeks ago, which actually went very well, which sort of went to it in some detail. But at a high level, I think it'll be good to just hit the main points, because the fact of the matter is, as you say, we've moved from one mode of operation years ago to a completely different mode of operation now. And in the process, well, we are being very much held hostage in a way, aren't we?
Well, yes. So what happened? Basically, around the GFC, there were lots of advancements in unconventional gas. And that is, gas that's extracted via fracking or coal seam gas, these kind of things that were new methods that were born out of the US Shale Revolution. And they arrived here, just before the GFC, and came with a lot of international capital that wanted to extract gas from coal seams in Queensland. And so just after the GFC, about six LNG trains, that is basically a gigantic freezer, what each train is like a freezer, were commissioned and built on Curtis Island in Queensland. And that is a lot of export capacity, six trains. And so, your viewers may remember that post GFC, everyone was shocked that interest rates were rising, when no one really expected it. And that was largely because of this gas boom that we had. And the RBA decided at that time that they needed to make room for the gas boom. That is to prevent it from causing inflation, because there was a lot of labor and just a general business investment boom around the construction of these plants, because they're huge, and there were a number in WA as well, but the East Coast ones are the ones that matter for our story. And so 4 years later they opened, and that was the point at which we connected our domestic gas market, which had always been isolated from global pricing, to international markets, because suddenly we're exporting gas at international prices. And so to acquire gas locally, you had to compete with that, with these exporters of gas, the producers. Now, what went horribly wrong in this is that the cartel, as I call them, the gas production and export cartel, overestimated its reserves when they commissioned these six plants. They did not have as much gas as they said they would, or said they did. You can debate whether it was a foolhardy assessment or lies. I actually think it was probably the latter. But nonetheless, it was a frenzy of investment, really a bubble at the time, that over-delivered overcapacity. And so instead of just exporting their own gas reserves, the owners of the LNG trains started to suck up all the excess reserves out of the domestic market and exporting those as well. And needless.
David, can I just ask, those entities, are they Australian companies or are they international companies or?
Consortiums made up of both. So
Okay.
there are three. I'm not going to get all of this right, but one of them is led by Santos. And they were the most short of gas, and so you can sort of point the finger of them at them as most responsible. They're partnered with KOGAS from Korea and Tokyo Gas, obviously from Japan, and I think Chevron. Don't hold put a gun to my head on these. These are roughly right. The other two are one of them's led by Origin. In partnership with, I think, Sinopec, a Chinese SOE, and some others. And the last one is owned by Shell, with, I think, Sihanouk, which is another Chinese SOE. But those might be back to front, I'm not sure.
But the point is, a lot of that is offshore, which means that the profits go offshore, right?
Oh yes, nearly all the profits go
Yep.
offshore.
Yep.
Yeah. Now, I mean, the interesting part about it was there virtually were no profits for years, because the capacity the export capacity was so enormous that it contributed to a major international gas glut, and the price crashed. So they were making almost no money from exporting gas. But because they left the domestic market short, they were making heaps of money by gouging us instead. So they actually, for many years, made no money in the exports, but made plenty from engineering discriminatory pricing for Australians. So it was
So are you saying that at one point our gas prices domestically in Australia were higher than the global prices?
They most certainly were in 2017.
Yep.
Like we had a local price of $20. It was well above the Japanese price.
Right.
Who were at the time the major customer. China is now. And that was actually what triggered the first round of policy attempts to fix it, which was Turnbull's Australian Domestic Gas Security Mechanism, ADGSM, which was a heads of agreement between the Prime Minister and the gas cartel. That is effectively a handshake, you know, written on a piece of paper. That they would keep the domestic volumes sufficient, and that worked quite well for a few years. Crashed the price again, and so that was good. And what's really screwed the pooch now, though, of course, is since the Ukraine war, is Russian sanctions have knocked out an enormous supplier of international gas. Europe is, you know. Gas in Europe is literally now a part of an economic war by Russia on Europe, and they just keep. I mean, Putin keeps squeezing Europe with less and less gas. So, needless to say, the price has gone through the roof there. The Americans are trying to export a lot of LNG now to Europe to offset that, but it's not enough to fill the hole. And so these international prices have gone crazy, and so we're talking in Europe at the moment at least $60 in Europe at the moment, gigajoule. And Australian prices have followed those prices over the last 3 or 4 months because these LNG exporters have just imported those prices to Australia. And it's become almost impossible for locals to acquire gas unless they're paying those prices. So, you know, the regulator stepped in and capped it at $40 a gigajoule, remembering that the traditional price is $4, and it's gone as high as like 60 or 70 in some states at various times. So we're talking, you know, phenomenal inflation in gas. Now, that would be bad enough, you know, because that basically is going to wipe out your manufacturing base as well as give you some pretty nasty bill inflation. But there's a huge amplifier in this for electricity prices.
Yep.
Because gas is the marginal price setter in the national electricity market, because it's the fuel that is most flexible in terms of offering baseload power when, you know, renewables aren't available, or coal's not available, because coal's not flexible. Coal you can't turn it off, on and off. Gas you can. And so whenever there's a need to adjust the system, it's gas that comes in when you need quick extra power. And so it sets the marginal price in the auctions. And so the electricity price over the last 3 months has gone from, you know, roughly $50 a megawatt hour to an average of about 300, but with price spikes to 600 on a regular basis. So if you add all of that together, what you get is a massive energy shock for the entire East Coast economy. And by East Coast economy, I mean everywhere except WA and Northern Territory. And, you know, where we calculate that it equals about an added 6% to CPI over the next 12 months or more. And, you know, the RBA has been mentioning this in all of its collateral statement of monetary policy and minutes and what have you, that they see these price rises coming. They drip in over an extended period because contracts roll off. Most people are on quarterly contracts with their provider of electricity. And then there's a bunch of regulatory things that slow the drip of the prices. And so it will come in slowly, but it'll be like 20% every quarter for a year more. So it's potentially going to force the RBA to a neutral interest rate that is being artificially inflated by any by this ludicrous energy prices from Europe, and at which the underlying economy can't cope. So, if it's allowed to go on, I think it's absolutely certain we'll be in recession sooner rather than later.
Right. So it's a very big factor in the current inflationary story, but your
Well,
point is,
not so far,
your
right?
but your point is going ahead, it's going to become more and
Oh,
more critical, right?
absolutely. Like you've got at the moment goods inflation largely from offshore, but to some a little bit of it locally through building materials and stuff, but mostly offshore has been driving inflation, and that's all about to fall, right? So there's lots of big inflation deflationary forces building in the global economy, coming out of China especially. So a lot of the drivers of inflation we've had over the last 6 to 12 months are about to all just plunge. But uniquely, Australia has given itself this energy shock. Well, not uniquely, Europe, Australia and Europe. And so as that other inflation dissipates, we'll get this new wave of coming from energy. So it will definitely force the RBA higher if the government doesn't fix it in a hurry. And they've already been too slow. Like they need to get on it. But that is where there is some good news in the story, which is this week, the ACCC, bless it, finally came out and put this report out that condemned the gas cartel for what it's doing. And this was the single most angry document I've ever seen the ACCC produce. Like it was brilliant. Basically, described the cartel down to a T, described monopoly behaviours, described horrendous bad behaviours. It went into it in depth, and the gas and oil and gas lobby came out today and yesterday saying they'd been demonised. Well, what the ACCC described were demons, energy demons. Like they weren't demonized, it's just what they've been up to. So this report obviously, is a real turning point for the political economy in terms of the possibility of regulatory action from the Albanese government. In fact, it's almost impossible for them to ignore the report. And it can give them cover if they want to move on the cartel and really come down on it hard, which is what they should do.
So the report said there was something like 56 petajoules missing next year.
Yeah,
Worst
that's
case.
right. Which is quite a lot. But this is also part of the problem, like the reservation mechanism that we have at the moment, the Malcolm Turnbull one, ADGSM, is based on volumes. So the ACCC has looked at volumes and said, okay, we're going to be short next year. So, the exporters need to be forced to leave more gas here. And that's fine. And that's good, except there's no price trigger in it. And, how those volumes are distributed will matter. What speed they're distributed will matter. And do you want to just leave all of that in the hands of this blood-sucking cartel that is obviously going to put its rentier profits ahead of the public interest on this question? So that it, the regulatory structure isn't right yet. And if I were the Albanese government, I would simply put a price trigger into the reservation mechanism, which just, you know, just scatters the roaches. You know, at that point, they just got to meet the price and volumes and export contracts and everything else don't matter. You know, they just got to put enough gas into the local market to meet the price, and then everything else follows from that. They can default on their export contracts if they need to. We don't need to worry about what sort of volume's coming into the market because it's just going to be sufficient to meet the price. And it's just a simple way of forcing, you know, their hand. That's where we've gotten to. That's a fine solution. It's good enough. And that's the one I've kind of been pushing in the media, the MSM, that is, the dumb media, not the smart media. But the reason I chose to do that was because I basically had no faith that Labor had the gumption to do a proper fix, nor that our media was smart enough to argue for it. But I could be wrong. We could end up there. The best solution would actually be an export levy, which would be you basically just set a baseline price pre-Ukraine war for gas. And incidentally, this is only half the problem. They're going to have to do this coal next. Good luck with that. So you set a baseline price for gas, pre-Ukraine price, say it's $8 a gigajoule, and every cent that they export above that, you just goes to the Australian Treasury. And so the windfall profits coming out of the war, which is war profiteering, right, just goes to the Australian people instead of to the companies that never invested on that basis nor deserve it. And that will also implicitly crash the local price of gas. So that's your absolute best-in-class solution. You can get there in a more clumsy way if you did, say, gas reservation and a super profits tax. That'd give you the same result. And it was actually Tony Wood that argued that's what we should do today at the AFR, Tony Wood of the Grattan Institute. Which would be good as well, although it's a lot less efficient than just doing a levy. And I hope we get to those solutions because they're actually the proper solutions to the problem. But I just, you know, having been battered and bruised on this subject and so many others, I'm trying to get decent policy through, you know, our parliamentary sausage factory. I went for the most basic outcome that would at least stop Australians from being screwed if it isn't going to result in them actually making money, which actually they should be. At least we can stop them being screwed. So I'm hopeful we'll get there. There are mixed signals, very mixed signals, coming from Labor. The ACCC report was supported by the Mad King, our resource minister, Madeleine King, Chicken Chalmers, the treasurer, and Albo himself. But it was done with a fairly, nod and a wink to the gas cartel at the same time, saying, you know, don't worry, we'll find solutions that put you at the front of the queue and stuff like that. So I'm not sure. I think we'll get there. And the other good news is, of course, as this has really heated up over the last week, lo and behold, the gas prices crashed.
Yes.
So, you know, there's a couple of reasons for that. One of the LNG trains has gone into maintenance, so there's more gas and stuff like that. But the gas price does not crash in Australia without the gas cartel's permission, right? So they're basically, you know, starting to game the system to take the heat out of the issue. So all of this kind of steely gaze from Canberra is having an effect already, and electricity prices are starting to crash as well as gas goes down. So you know, the last 3 or 4 days in particular has seen this emergence of this cheaper energy. And this is actually, while the international price has gone the other way, it's gone higher and higher. Europe and Asia fight over gas supplies, basically. So we may get there. We've made some progress.
And it's interesting because if you look at our export of LNG, we're probably the number one now globally, aren't we, or pretty close to it?
We were until recently. The US has overtaken us now.
Yeah.
Because they have a ludicrous amount of gas in the US. A lot of the gas there, in fact, just comes out as a byproduct from fracking, shale fracking. Like they actually make the money out of the oil, and the gas is free. So for years and years before they built a few pipelines recently, they were just flaring the gas, just burning it. But anyway, it's worth something now. But yeah, we're now second, and we'll fall further behind. Qatar has got a very large new tranche of gas coming in 2 or 3 years, so we'll end up number three over the next few years. Our volumes are unlikely to rise. We don't really have a lot of investment queued here. Most of the good reserves have been accessed, and there are others actually, but there was just such a big plunge after the GFC here that we became such a big exporter that most of, when firms are looking at building new plants and they look at Australia, a lot of the customers want greater diversification of supply and things like that. So, our great gas boom is done. So now we've just got to try and fix what we did to ourselves.
And let me just explore with you the relationship between the gas cartel members and, government, right? Is there a deadly embrace there? I mean, who's leading the shots?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oil and gas. What can you say about oil and gas? I mean, it's real business is manipulating governments. And they're doing a very good job in Australia. Through the last, almost decade of coalition governments, they have run the shop. There's been, Turnbull did a good job with his ADGSM, but beyond that, we had Rex Patrick, the independent senator, tried to fix this in 2019, and he did a deal with Scott Morrison, I think, when he was treasurer, not prime minister, to give him his tax cuts at the time in return for a stronger gas reservation. And then, ScoMo took the tax cuts and then never delivered his side of the bargain. And then we had the gas-led recovery, later on, coming out of COVID, I think, round one, which was, just absolutely cooked up by gas interests, and that was all about trying to dig up the Narrabri gas, a big unconventional gas field, which is another debacle, because there was a great deal, there still is a lot of local resistance to it, because this process is pretty dirty. It digs up some quite nasty salts, carcinogenic salts, and I'm talking millions and millions of tons of this stuff, and everyone's afraid it's going to end up in the water table. And so the New South Wales chief scientist was commissioned to do a study on it and to ensure that the gas could only be extracted safely, and she came up with 16 conditions, but then gas cartel pressure in the New South Wales Parliament, and that never saw the light of day. So these are all incidences where the gas cartel has manipulated the political economy in one form or another to ensure its profits are maximised, its regulation is minimised, and it can just go on doing what it's doing. Yeah.
Right. So they're very powerful. They've got a lot of influence. So I guess the question is, what's the chances then of...
I mean, you can see that even Labor now, like the Mad King, the resource minister, is still using gas talking points all the time. I've seen their material in Parliament. Yeah, it's pretty biased.
So they are quite effective, aren't they, also in the media at making sure that they get their story across. I've noticed that quite often as well.
Yeah. Look, the last few weeks have been interesting. Most of them, MSM has ignored it, particularly The Australian, which is an interesting outcome. But it tells you that then right now they're not at war with the Albanese government. It tells you at least that much. But the AFR is very much in their embrace. It's publishing absolute rubbish on a daily basis, just propaganda. They certainly got a hold of the AFR, but that's as much about their ideological standpoint as it is gas party influence or gas cartel influence. I mean, the AFR would sell its mother to a corporate psychopath. Well, it would. I mean, if you're a business, the AFR loves you. End of story. You know, it's not a newspaper that pursues national interest or a well-defined economic reform anymore. It's a business propaganda newspaper. You know, trickle-down economics, businessomics, which has got nothing to do with functioning markets, you know, which is what liberalism is supposed to be about, you know, not vested interests, monopolies, oligopolies. But that's what the AFR cheers on these days.
Absolutely. And you can add the financial system, services and everybody else to the same, same party, right?
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So, I guess that's where we're at.
And so one other question, what's the Greens' view of all of this? Because, I mean, they presumably have quite a powerful position now in the Senate.
I'm not sure on the specifics. I've certainly read quite a bit of material from Greens and Greens associated staff saying, we don't want to dig up more gas. You know, it's a fossil fuel, even though it's cleaner, much cleaner than coal. Let's just let renewables fix the problem. And certainly it is the case that these very high fossil fuel prices will accelerate the transition to renewables. The problem is that it can't happen fast enough to avoid catastrophic consequences for the economy, you know, both for households and manufacturing. And so, the renewables transition's coming anyway. And obviously it should come as quickly as possible, but I'm not sure why we have to commit suicide along the way, economic suicide.
Well, it just seemed a bit unnecessary, really, when there's
obvious answer. Don't forget, I've been pushing climate change mitigation my entire career, I'm on board. But I don't think, you know, there's just some pragmatics here that you do yourself a lot of harm if it's not managed a little bit.
Yep.
And gas was always the key bridging fuel, you know. That's what was so egregious about this cartel arriving and just spoiling the party, you know, in our carbon transition.
Yeah, absolutely. And, of course, we have a lot of gas. A lot of it's going offshore. We're getting a little bit for our own needs, but at a certain price. So you can almost see, you know, the two scenarios ahead, right? If they don't buckle down and get this sorted, then we're going to be in a very, very high inflationary, high cost environment with very high energy, and that's a big recession, right?
Yep.
If they do,
I mean, well, I will add.
Yeah.
The hilarious part about it is the RBA can't affect this energy price at all, right? So what it will do is offset it with deflation in other areas, i.e. house prices.
Yes.
And consumption. So it just means it has to go higher for longer and create more deflation to make room for this like incredibly useless inflation that's in energy and spilling over into everything else as a result.
Yeah, right. So you know, the nightmare scenario is that way. The other scenario is one which is to benefit Australia and Australians, but it would involve inflicting some pain on the cartel.
Yeah, and I mean, there are two strands to that. That is, they do it properly, and it inflicts a lot of pain on the cartel by taking their windfall profits off them from the war. Or you do the basic path, which is to just stop them screwing Australia with war profiteering gouging. So, you know, I hope Labor can at least get to the second. But, you know, if we had any half-decent policymakers, they would have already done what the UK has done.
Yes.
Or what, you know, Norway did when they set up their oil fund. You know, that's like got a 78% tax rate.
Yep.
You know, and these our gas cartel pays no tax.
Yep.
Either. Like, yeah.
How does that work? We're actually helping them rather than them helping us.
Well, that's right. You know, our gas export industry, which is $80 billion roughly at the moment, has been turned into an import.
Yep.
Right. Like we're just paying an enormous sum to a foreign cartel to take our gas away. It's an import. Yeah. Like we're importing evil, basically, paying a lot to import evil.
Now,
corporate evil.
Yeah, that's right. Plenty of that around. Now, before the election, I can remember Albanese talking about, well, we can't pull the gas trigger, et cetera, because if we do, we're going to create sovereign risk and all of those things. And in fact, there was a conversation article published this week going down that same route.
So, yes, by Professor Idiot. I don't know what his real name is, but it wasn't making any sense. His argument was that we don't want to go down, get embroiled in a legal dispute with the cartel. If we pull the trigger on gas reservation. And his analogy was what happened with Philip Morris and plain packaging on cigarettes, which cost the government $24 million in legal fees. My answer to that is, well, I think it's unlikely we end up there because at the end of the day, the cartel is making money hand over fist here, and why would it want to risk those profits? You know, the export profits. They will still make money on any one of the proposals for domestic renovation on their domestic volumes as well. And so nobody's seriously talking about taking those profits away, although I think we should be. You know, the Treasurer has explicitly ruled out super profits taxes, unfortunately. So I think it's very unlikely that they would go legal. But if they did, bring it on. You know, take them on. They can't win. They don't make the laws. You know, Australian people do. So take them on. A $24 million legal bill versus a $50 billion tax on the East Coast economy, privately levied tax. Energy tax, you know, it's a bit of a no-brainer.
Yes.
You know, that they're sucking that much out of the East Coast economy.
And just putting that in context, right, you know, there's a $1 trillion debt burden, you know, because of all of the government expenditure in the last two or three years in particular, which is no way to actually reduce it. But this would actually be a way of helping to reduce the overall burden of government debt, wouldn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
Mm.
Be a huge windfall.
Yep.
Yeah, be massive. Which is what we should be doing, but I don't think we've got it in us. I don't think Canberra does. You know, they're just these contemporary politicians. They're just weak.
Yes, are they weak or are they actually just going down a different ideological track? You know, and I'm thinking Treasury here in particular, who seems to me at least to be disconnected.
Yeah, to some extent, but. Mm. But even within, you know, I mean, yes, within sort of very, very base and basic trickle-down economics, I guess you could defend what's going on, I guess, but not even there, really. So weak and corrupt, I think, is probably more accurate. But, you know, yes, institutional stupidity is part of it.
Yeah. Right. So it isn't, the point is, this isn't just a perpetuation of neoliberal values, right? Because you'd sometimes argue, well, it's to maximise profit. The point there is that isn't even what's happening here, if you look at it.
No. From, No. And, I mean, anyone who's read, you know, The Wealth of Nations,
mm.
by Adam Smith, mm. you know, would probably also read The Theory of Moral Sentiments by Adam Smith and understand that he would look at this and just shake his head.
Yes.
It doesn't work as a liberal or neo-liberal outcome. No. What this is a failed market.
Yeah.
Like, this is
it's policy fail or a mega, mega fail.
Yeah, yeah, this is an outright
power,
outright fail, Mark.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it's far worse than I've seen in any other third world resource cursed country.
Mm.
Like, if we were poor as a nation and this were happening, this would be a catastrophe. The only reason we can manage it is we're rich, but I'm not sure why we will still want to do it. And especially given it's, you know, the consequences are by far the worst for the poor in this case. It's highly regressive because, you know, utility bills are so much more. Such a larger proportion of less well-off discretionary income,
yes,
than the rich.
Yep.
You know, so like I think I was looking at these numbers the other day from it might have been Hilda or I can't remember, but it was already about. Like the rich was like 1% of their discretionary income was utility bills, and poor it was like 8%. And if the price rises that we're talking about come through over the next 12 months, it goes to like 15% of their discretionary income goes on utility bills. You know, like that's an enormous
yep.
standard of living drop. But for what?
Yeah, well, I'm seeing that in my survey. So already, you know, a lot of households have difficulty trying to measure up to all the demands on their budgets, the energy costs and fuel costs, those things. Those are huge for them, as you say. It's a it's not just a couple of percent; it's a massive proportion.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, they feel completely helpless because, well, what do? You use fuel or do you not use fuel? You know,
No, it's debilitating.
Yeah, absolutely it is. Yeah, and what the other point, of course, is the energy cost to industry will also make it harder for industry and manufacturing in particular to survive here as well.
Well, this will end manufacturing.
Mm.
Like if it's allowed to go ahead. This idea of the Albanese government that they will revitalise that manufacturing is laughable if they don't fix this. It'll be the end of Australian manufacturing, in effect.
Yep.
because they just will not be able to compete. You know, metals processing, forget it. Building materials, forget it. We'll be importing bricks, you know, if this goes ahead. Well, yeah, they use gas.
Yep.
Yeah. You know, like anything, energy is so important to manufacturing, and so it'll all fly offshore. And, of course, 71% of this gas is going to China.
Yes, I was going to ask about that. Mm.
So we'll be building their manufacturing while we decimate our own.
Well, it's pretty much got to the point where the LNG exports to China is that one of our biggest now, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah,
I'm not sure if it's overtaken iron ore. It may have.
It's pretty close. The last time I looked, yeah.
Yeah, I think the coals did recently, but yeah, perhaps not LNG yet. Yeah, so the whole thing is crazy, bottom to top. It's crazy, you know, and you know the. You never let the perfect get in the way of the good in Australian politics. Or you'll be waiting a long time. Mm. And so this is why reservation is my hope.
Mm.
Yeah. I mean, if, you know, all my Christmases will come at once if we get better than that. But right. That has to be the minimum that we get to. Tougher reservation with a decent price trigger in it.
And can you introduce that retrospectively, or do you have to wait for the new contracts to tick over to get those reservations put into them?
No, you couldn't really control that. But, I mean, the good news on that front is we're only, like, what, 3 months into this shock, maybe 4 months.
Mm.
And so the big contracts, you know, they'll be more than quarterly. They'll be... You know, a lot of those are annual and multi-year.
Mm.
And so, you know, if you act quickly, you're going to short circuit it before it happens.
Right. So that's why the imperative is so critical.
Yeah, partly. Yep. The other thing is that the national electricity market prices off spot.
Yep.
Gas spot, not contract.
Mm.
And so it's very, very sensitive to these movements in the gas price.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then there's the delay. The delay comes in the quarterly contracts from the retailers with you.
Yep.
Quarterly and annual.
Yeah. Which just go up and up and up and up.
Yes, they do. Well, they have gone up and up and up and up on because of this.
Yes.
You know, we used to do 25 megawatts per hour before 2014.
Mm.
Since then, it's crept up and up. It's doubled since then. As a kind of average price. But the problem here is we're talking about 600% in a year.
Yeah. I mean, that's crazy. It's interesting. Just for comparison, in the UK, they're talking there about energy cost doubling plus within 6 to 12 months.
Yeah.
Right?
It's almost identical.
Yeah. And they're saying something like 20% of UK households will not be able to afford energy by the time we get to December.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the sort of quantum we're talking about.
Yeah. And that's before Putin turns off another tap.
Correct. This is with 20%, right?
Yeah. I mean, Europe is quietly preparing its population for gas privations.
Yes.
Like they are actually accumulating enough gas at the moment in storage that, you know, it's roughly on track where it has been in past years despite the loss of Russian volumes. But they're kind of doing a dry run on the possibility that the gas gets cut off completely in winter.
Mm.
And so they're preparing the population for what they should do in that event.
Yeah.
Which is pretty sensible because it's quite possible.
And just as an aside, of course, Germany in particular, you know, was very, very on to Russian gas for a long, long time, right? And that now appears to be being a political failure as well as an economic failure.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know what they were thinking.
Yeah.
And this is one win for Donald Trump. Well, he went over there and said, he said, "What are you guys thinking?"
Yeah, no, that's true.
Yeah, why don't you get some American LNG, because you're hanging yourself out to dry here.
Yeah,
proved correct. Yeah. I mean, that's not to say that wasn't in bed with Putin in other ways, but they miscalculated.
Mm. Yep. And the sort of and just, you know, a very simple example, they've actually turned off the heating in some public showers, so you can only get cold showers when you go to the swimming pool.
Yeah, now, right? Yeah. Oh, street lights, all sorts of stuff.
Exactly.
Like I think office lighting and heating and everything at night is all gone.
Yep. Yeah.
Like it's full on rationalizing.
Yep.
And if Putin really turns the tap or the screw during winter, it's going to get really, really ugly.
Mm, absolutely.
You know, it will be energy poverty.
Yep, absolutely. Now, there was the question that came in a little while ago, which I just want to throw at you, because I think it's a really very important one. How can we get more awareness within the general public about windfall and excess profits from the fossils and all the majors, every sector at the moment? So there is a big question here about, this is not well understood broadly, is it?
No, it's not. And it's not well understood in the ranks of people that should understand it.
Yeah.
And I know this because I've spent the last week, like virtually all day in the media, talking to various hoi polloi telling this story, and they all are shocked by it.
Right.
Like the very senior people don't understand what's happening. How can we improve it? I don't know. I mean, my phone's been running red hot this week, you know, because we've had the ACCC report and stuff to trigger news interest. But you know, that's gonna wane probably by tomorrow.
Yes.
We'll be back to square one.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I write about it every day just to keep the heat on Labor. try and, you know, make sure that somebody's getting up them to get a good solution. Other than that, you know, if they don't move, then inflation's going to get them.
Yep.
And it will become apparent that energy was the cause, you know. So I would have thought that the opposition at a certain point would move on this as well.
But but would they move in the right direction, or would they fall on the side?
Yeah, I think they would if Labor doesn't move, isn't tough enough quickly enough, and we get the rate hikes and real incomes and house prices are going backwards really fast.
Mm.
Like as we're entering recession at the end of this year and into next year, then I think they'd be crazy not to be jumping up and down and saying this is Labor's fault. Why haven't they fixed energy?
Mm.
We did it in 2017.
Yeah.
You know, we warned you. You know, life won't be easy under Albanese. So I would have thought so. I mean, that's an irresistible line of attack. More awareness, I don't know. I mean, I think the best thing people can do to try and get their change on this is to write to their MP, to the Labor MP.
Mm. Yep.
Because the solutions are incredibly easy.
Well, as you said in your other show, it's a stroke of a pen, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just it's hard politically. Well, I don't think it's even hard politically, to be perfectly honest. I mean, if Albo got up and just explained this, you know, every day for 2 weeks, for 2 minutes, then it's not that complex. You know, the LNG exporters lied to us about how much gas they had. So they took gas they said they wouldn't, and now we don't have enough. So they're going to wear the solution. They're going to provide the gas. And we're going to make it at a reasonable price.
Yep.
Thanks for coming.
It sounds so simple when you say it like that.
Well, that's what happened. Then you can throw a bit of Ukraine war profiteering in there if you want to sex it up.
Yeah.
And then just say we're putting the hammer down.
Well, maybe the thing to do is to draw the other way. Say, well, this is a way of keeping house prices more stable, right?
Oh, look, you'd definitely talk about the economic consequences.
Mm.
And say, look, if we don't do this, there'll be 6% more CPI and the Reserve Bank will go nuts. So we have to do it. We have to do it for your good, our good, and the nation's good. And by the way, this is a blood-sucking foreign cartel.
Absolutely. It's
not a hard message.
No.
But, you know, you look at the Mad King, who... our resources minister, Madeleine King, who, you know, uses the gas cartel talking points so often, and it's, you know, they're trying to play both sides of the fence.
Yes.
They don't want to offend anyone. You know, like,
so
their own history of offending mining didn't end well. So,
and I was going to say, one of the things that I've noticed about the political, you know, machinations is they sort of try and come somewhere in the middle, right?
Yeah,
it's sort of, we don't want to upset anybody, so we'll try and find. But there is no middle ground on this, is there really?
No, there isn't.
So that's going to be difficult.
I mean, I guess I'm arguing gas reservation is the middle ground.
Mm.
It's not really what they should be doing, but it will still provoke a massive backlash from the cartel. And it's funny. I read some research today from Credit Suisse, who are pretty good on gas. And they warned that if we put in reservation, Origin's profits would fall 3%.
3%?
3%.
Well, yeah. That's not huge, is it?
No. It's freaking nothing. Yeah, but they'll make it sound like it's 30.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's just, we don't have anyone with any... intelligence, vision, or perhaps most importantly, gumption in politics.
Yep.
You know, they're all ciphers for this interest or that.
I think, unless there's anything else you want to discuss with regard to the energy story, I mean, I think it's very clear that, you know, there is a path. And it's interesting, the poll that we did earlier on, I sort of only could put 4 up. So should we fix, should we fix energy prices, reservation, windfall tax, price control, consumer rebates? The poll also said reservation. There you go. So even the poll says it.
Oh, I know. What was the numbers?
What were the numbers?
Yeah.
Yeah. So let me just
go. It was a majority for reservation?
Yeah, 71% for reservation.
Yeah.
18%.
So the thing is, this is why I opted for it, because it's an understandable, sensible idea.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
That is, they've taken away too much gas. Mm. Let's take it back because it's ours.
Yeah. Well, we own it.
We own it. Exactly.
Yeah.
Quite right. And at the end of the day, if we do that, the damage, like through this week, as gas prices have been falling and Labor's gotten more aggressive, all of the gas share market prices have gone up. You know, like there's no fear in the stock market over it.
Yeah.
It's all, a lot of it's just cartel pantomime.
Yes.
And cowardly pollies.
Yes. Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm hopeful we'll get as far as reservation.
Yeah, yeah. Well, at least, you know, we had quite a few people on so far, and 771 so far, that's good. And at least we're spreading the word. And I actually quite like the idea of, you know, writing to pollies and saying, hey, this is important, right? We've done this before with the cash ban and got the right outcome there. So it's a, you know, very important to get this message out, because I think we're at a crossroads, right? There isn't this middle ground thing. No, you've either got to say, we're just going to roll over and, you know, inflation is going to go through the roof, or we're going to do something significant and substantive to change the game. And the game can be changed. And if we can change the game, then effectively Australia and Australians win.
Yes. And if well, at least they don't lose. Mm. Like, that is a win in Australia.
Yeah, that's true.
So, I mean, if they were to jam through a price trigger reservation that say $7 a gigajoule tomorrow, the electricity markets in South Australia, Tasmania, and Victoria would all go back to normal, more or less. New South Wales and Victoria would still be very expensive because they're very coal dependent still, coal and gas dependent. And this is where, you know, it gets a bit more complicated, and that is they may have to do this with coal as well.
Right, because it's a bit the same, isn't it?
Yes, it is the same. You know, we had a phenomenal outcome a few weeks ago where Origin, that is one of the card-carrying members of the gas cartel, had to put out a profit warning because it couldn't get enough coal for its power plants. Because the coal cartel was eating the gas cartel. Right? That's Australia for you.
Yeah. It could only happen here.
It could only happen. Well, no, it's happened. It has happened elsewhere. Like, I mean, one of the great energy debacles of all time was Enron in the US. And that was kind of similar to this in a lot of ways. Enron was deliberately starving California of power to drive up prices. And it turned into an election issue. And they basically ran the Democratic candidate out of town, which is when Arnold Schwarzenegger got elected. Mm. And George W. Bush backed Enron and everything in this incredible manipulation of market pricing.
Yep.
And then 6 months later, they collapsed in an enormous corruption scandal and the whole truth came out. And it's actually not that dissimilar to Enron. It's like ginormous Enron in Australia.
Mm. Absolutely. Well, who is the smartest guys in the room, right?
Yes, that's right. Exactly.
So before we go, I just wanted to just broaden the conversation slightly because, of course, the RBA did their 50 basis points today and said, well, you know, we'll be data dependent, et cetera, et cetera. Just give us your top line thoughts strategically about what they're doing. Do they know what they're doing? And where are we headed based on what we understand them to be doing?
Do they know what they're doing? Yes and no. What do I think they're going to do next? Well, Bill Evans is out this afternoon saying another 50 basis points at the next meeting.
Yes.
Bill is not afraid of being dovish. And right now he's still very hawkish.
Yep.
So that's not a temperament problem with Bill. So he's an interesting bellwether to track. I think if they go another 50, they are shooting the economy in the head. The fact that they went data dependent today, I think, is a lot more significant here than it was in the US. Fed went data dependent last week. But they've still got a much more embedded inflation problem there. They actually have a wage cycle going, whereas we don't. We've got an energy problem. So if Albo were to put in reservation and keep the recent deflation of energy prices going, I think the RBA would revert very quickly to 25s and stop very quickly.
Yep.
Their problem is is not just the inflation. The problem is the fixed rate reset.
Yep.
Like, which doesn't really get moving in earnest until the end of the year,
yep,
moving into next year. Like, it has just started, really. And so it's going to intensify from here. And if they were to go like another 1% from here, that reset next year will be calamitous. Like, it'll be such an enormous shock. There'll just be a rolling tightening every month on, you know, $500 billion in mortgages. John Mott was out today with a report, very good bank analyst, saying, you know, that if they get this wrong, we're looking at $250 billion in losses.
Yep.
In bad loans. You know, which I think is more indeed plausible if the RBA gets this wrong. So I would expect them to ease off pretty quick from here, especially if Albo puts in the reservation. That would reassure them that energy and its spillovers is taken care of. And so this is the urgency behind what Albo's doing, or not doing. So that, I mean, if they don't, then they are that. If Albo does not do this, I think the RBA will chase the energy spillovers, which is really stupid, but I think they will. So if I were to, so in other words, it's critical that Albo does this.
Yep.
Or he is damning the economy to a big recession.
Yep.
Next year, because the RBA cannot affect these prices. Like, which is the lunacy of it. That's why they shouldn't do it. They can't affect the prices, but what they can do is dramatically affect other prices as an offset, and they will.
Yep.
Which is crazy, I think, but they will. So, so that's really the big question. If we get the domestic reservation and diminishing energy prices, then I would expect the RBA to stop hiking pretty quick from here.
And
because we are obviously we're. Your viewers will be well aware that we're seeing like really dramatic price falls in Sydney and Melbourne.
Yep.
House prices. We're seeing the leading edge of consumption slow down. Housing construction boom. COVID housing construction boom is already well off its peaks. It'll keep crashing. Consumption goes. There is still a big infrastructure impulse in the economy, but that starts to plateau from here, and that will fall in 2023, which the RBA will be aware of. And if they smack consumption too hard at this point, they'll lose business investment next. And
And what about the Aussie dollar? Because that's the other thing I'm sort of interested in terms of the dynamics between what we do here and what the Fed does. That seems to me to be a very important linkage as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the Fed, has the difficult position of managing mortgages through the bond market. That is, you know, all American, nearly most American mortgages are fixed rate and set at 30-year bond rate. And so it's a much, much more difficult way of transmitting monetary policy changes to housing. Like, it can be much slower because you're only affecting new borrowing because everyone's on the fixed rate.
Yes.
So their housing market, the prices are still going up there, like 1% a month. Like, they are slowing if you look on the internals, and their housing construction boom is absolutely coming apart. But their inventories for sale are still quite low, and so I'm not expecting a price crash in the US. So, in other words, you know, the inflation that they've got there doesn't have an immediate outlet to like it does here in housing. Like, if the RBA goes hard enough, it's just going to crash housing and it's all over for inflation, right? The US Fed doesn't have that luxury. So thanks for calling it a luxury. So I think the Fed has to go further than the RBA. And so on the dollar, I'm still bearish, basically.
Mm.
I mean, I'm still pretty bearish for the whole global economy. I think the Fed has to still do more. I think consumption will continue to stall in the US, and they have started a negative inventory cycle there, working off this enormous inventory pile, but I think it's got a lot further to go. And that's just going to spill over in as a trade shock into China, which is screwed, and Europe, which is double screwed.
Mm.
And so I think we're going to have a real global recession over the next 6 to 12 months. And that's not a good environment for the Aussie dollar either.
No, absolutely. And, of course, a falling Aussie dollar has significant consequences likely too.
It does. It's inflationary.
Yeah, funny that.
Although in this environment, I would expect commodity prices to get belted.
Yeah.
So, and they already have been, but I mean more. So I'm not concerned about that. In fact, the big story over the next year in terms of imports is deflation. There's a massive deflation wave coming.
Yep.
In goods imports.
And reduction in lending, because that's the other thing that I think that people haven't thought about.
Yes.
The credit impulse is already weakening, right?
Oh, yeah. Mm. Yeah. And globally, it's like plunging.
Yep.
If you put everyone together, the global credit impulse is absolutely gone through the trapdoor.
Yep.
And so that tells you where growth is going.
Yep.
And asset prices.
Yeah. Well, I've always held the thesis that long-term deflation is the spiral down is the most likely outcome of all this, because I don't think it's sustainable. And the only thing that would turn it around is credit going up again.
Yes. I'm not in the inflation school yet. I still think that the structural features are predominantly deflationary, certainly more inflationary than they were a few years ago. But I think the key one that everyone's gotten wrong is commodity prices. And that is a lot of the inflation story that's been evolving in markets over the last 12 months has been about deglobalization, nationalization of resources, geopolitical risk, all of these things being inflationary. But I think the thing that, and therefore buy commodities as an inflation hedge.
Yep.
And so that adds a financialization element to it. But I think the thing that everyone's missed and is now bearing out is that China's going ex-growth. Like, China boom's done. The great Chinese boom and commodity consumption story was about its property market.
Yep.
And it's built out.
Mortgage strikes.
Well, yeah. So it's built out, and there's still no suggestion that Chinese authorities want to bail it out. They look like they're very serious about structurally diminishing property's contribution to their economy. And that is to structurally diminish their commodity intake. And so that what was all this sort of virtuous cycle of inflationary forces, if you pull that stick out, it all collapses.
Right, you've got the demographic shifts there as well, because of the population growth. Yeah.
It's pure. It's just pure Japan.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you're going to end up with a massively deflationary China,
yep,
which is what is happening,
yep,
then how are you going to have global inflation, given it's going to or is the production center of the world?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, you'll have some with onshoring and deglobalization, but that'll take decades.
Yep.
Unless we suddenly have a Taiwan war or whatever. It all reverses. in a jiffy, but yeah, it's not. The China story is just so immensely deflationary that I'm yet to be convinced of inflationary outcomes.
David, last question before we sign off. Trade agreements. We've been in party to a few, all right, and there's still people advocating them. Have they done us a good service or have they not done us a good service?
Do you mean multilateral?
Yeah.
Or
well, I mean, some of them are multilateral, some of them aren't, right? So, you know, we've got very – but I'm interested in these sort of big sort of structural agreements.
Yes, I think the multilateral ones especially have done us good.
Mm.
There is something to be said for competitive advantage in terms of, you know, liberating spending power, reducing costs and all that stuff. That all works. Where you run into strife is when you let it run too far and allow yourself, your economy to get unbalanced, and which is what we've done. You know, where you allow your manufacturing to be run down to such a degree that you've got a lower proportion than Luxembourg, you know, and so that hamstrings your economy in all sorts of unexpected ways. Like, you know, it's very hard to value add when you don't have any manufacturing. It's very hard to generate productivity when you don't have any manufacturing.
Yes.
And it's very hard to defend yourself when you don't have any manufacturing, you know, which is this absurdity of the whole gas thing with China. So, you know, you just, yeah, I think in principle trade agreements are good, although I think the binary agreements are just trade distortion. That's not free trade.
Yep.
The multilateral agreements are good. But again, even in those, you just got to be careful what you give away and how unbalanced you let your economy become.
Mm. Yep.
They're all strategic questions that don't feature.
Nobody wants to ask those big picture questions, right? Which is coming back into the top down. That's what I think is missing in the way that we think about things in the Australian context so often. It's sort of micro sort of decisions and micro bits. Nobody's got the big picture, right?
Oh, no, we are unbelievably tactical in this country without being strategic at all.
Yeah.
Which is a really interesting mindset. Because if you're tactical without being strategic, you don't know where you're going.
No.
Like, you're very good at going somewhere.
Well, if you don't know where you're going, anywhere is fine, right?
Yeah, but that's right. But where that is, you have no clue.
No, exactly.
So, we're terrible strategic thinkers.
Yeah.
Which it probably just goes hand in hand with our kind of populist culture, like the anti-intellectualism of Australia, which is, you know, still rife these days, always has been. I'd say that's what it is. Because, you know, to think strategically, you need to be, you need a number of things. You need history, for a start. You need intellectual history as well as actual history. And you need engagement with both of those and curiosity about them. And none of these things typify Australiana.
Yeah.
You know, Australiana's hostile to all those things, in fact.
Well, so, it's the sun's shining. It's nice down at the beach. You know, we'll just.
Yeah. We're just fine about charm. Don't get me wrong. Like, I don't want to live anywhere else. Which is one reason why I fight some of these causes is because, you know, we deserve better.
Yeah. Well, I've always had the view that the potential, if we got our sort of strategic brain in gear and started thinking a little bit more, you know, above the everyday, we could be actually creating a very different economy and environment and society, right? Because the raw DNA that we've got there is huge, and the potential is huge. But nobody wants to get it by the throat and push it strategically in the right direction. They just want to sort of, you know, cycle around the current mode of operation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, then you get into you know, stuff about the role of vested interests and things, which is, you know, also very important in Australia. Like, we do have a, let's say, a quite a malleable value system. I'm not saying we're all psychopaths, but I think we probably do have some kind of convict heritage going on.
Yeah.
You know, where, you know, it's almost like if someone gets away with something, it's like, good on you. You know?
Yes. Well, somebody said to me when I first came to Australia, the sin is not, you know, crossing the line. The sin is being found out.
Yeah. So, yeah, I guess all of those factors contribute. And so, no, we're terrible at the big picture stuff.
Well, David, I want to say thanks very much. And it's been a very interesting conversation this evening. We've got nearly 1,000 views now, so that's good. If people want to find out more about you and where you write, where's the best place for you for them to go?
I write every day at Macro Business. So you can go there. I obviously work very strongly and regularly at Nucleus Wealth as well, write for them sometimes, but we do potties and all that, like we do with you, Martin, but there's more at Nucleus. And, you know, I'm so hot right now, Martin. I've been on Credlin tonight.
Well, so there you go. That explains a lot.
you can catch me on Credlin.
Congratulations. Well, you know, your time has come, David, right? This issue, you know, once it's on Credlin, it'll be broken open, right?
Yeah, well, it seems like a tipping point, but I'm not sure to what.
Well, thank you very much for your time this evening, and really appreciate you sharing your thoughts. And you know, I think this is a really, really important message, right? And we'll keep plugging away.
Absolute pleasure. Mm. Thanks for having me, Martin. And everyone, write to your Labor MP and tell them to put reservation in. At worst,
absolutely. Yeah. You know. Strike of a pen, we could solve a lot of inflationary issues, we could keep house prices up, and we could do a whole lot of other things, and, you know, so simple. Thank you. Thank you, David. Have a good evening.
Pleasure.
And I'm going to take you off offline now, and I'll just close the show.
Okay. See cheers, man.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So there you are, folks. Hope you found that an interesting conversation. Very, very thought-provoking and very, very important. Just before I go, to tell you that next week we're back on property, and I've got Veronica Morgan coming on to talk about property and the changes that have gone on recently in the property world. So that'll be a very important and interesting conversation. So join us for that next week. And I should, of course, just go back to the doggy cam to show you that, believe it or not, they've hardly moved at all evening. So there you go. Looks as though they've squabbled. They're at the far end of the bed. But there you go. That's just the way it is. So thank you very much for spending some time with us this evening. I hope you found that thought-provoking and, you know, a very, very, very important subject. So thanks for that. Do check out our other shows during the week. There's a lot going on at the moment. We'll be putting up quite a few shows. Tarek is coming on Friday, so he'll be making another show with me at the end of the week, and I've got some other people lined up. And next week I'm having a conversation with Roger Brown as well, so those of you who know him, that'll be also worth following up. And come and join us next Tuesday. So thanks for that. Have a good evening, and we'll see you next time. This is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, signing off. Cheerio.